people want to feel ennobled. They want a sense of belonging. They want to know that the company cares about their well-being. And by necessity, HR sometimes focuses on compliance and doesn't look at individuals. And we need to strike that balance. We need to rebel a little more towards the side of, let's make sure people are understanding that we actually do care about them. We need them. We want them to feel a sense of satisfaction in the work they do.
This is the Rebel HR Podcast, the podcast where we talk to HR innovators about all things people leadership. If you're looking for places to find about new ways to think about the world of work, this is the podcast for you. Please subscribe from your favorite podcast listening platform today and leave us a review. Rebel on, HR Rebels. Welcome back, Rebel HR listeners. Extremely excited for the conversation today. We have with us Deb Calvert. She is the founder and president of People First Productivity Solutions. We're going to dive into that here in just a minute. She was also, prior to that, an HR director for a Fortune 500 company, and really excited to have her here today. Welcome to the show, Deb.
Kyle, thank you. I have been binge listening to Rebel HR and just love what you're doing. Thank you.
Well, I appreciate it, and I appreciate you bringing some of your talent and expertise here. We are going to be talking a little bit about some innovation and some strong opinions that you have on some of the established talent procedures that we have. But before we get into that, I want to understand a little bit more about your background. So, tell me, what prompted you to found People First Productivity Solutions?
Well, about 18 years ago, I was working for that Fortune 500 that you mentioned, a media company, and they were an awesome company. They won every sort of award for people development and people practices, and they were innovators in that space. And it was just a delight to be in there. And then when they put themselves on the auction block, it's as if overnight everything changed, right? They stripped away to be more profitable, stripped away everything that really made them special. And I watched it. And as the company went through that process, coming into work felt like the longest funeral I'd ever been at, one day after another. And so I realized just what difference it really made when you put people first in an organization. And when I decided to strike out on my own, this notion of putting people first to build organizational strength, I realized that was something I highly prized. And that's the backstory.
I love that. Yeah. And I love the name, and the name People First. It's literally in the name, right? You know, it's not like it's like on the, you know, on page two of a mission statement document. Like it is the name of your organization. And certainly I think something that our listeners are probably, you know, connect with as it relates to the organization. So tell me a little bit about what the organization does. And then, you know, the other thing I want to mention is you also founded the People First Leadership Academy as well. So give you an opportunity to tell us a little bit about that.
Okay. I'll do it in reverse order because it'll make more sense. So People First Leadership Academy is about 2 years old now, and it is all about offering free and affordable content. We have about 40 some odd courses, e-learning, live sessions, immersion programs, coaching. It's all about for HR and managers and frontline folks to come in and be able to access something that helps them to find and liberate their hidden potential. And it too is about organizational strength. Where does that come from? Personal strength. Where does that come from? It comes from being able to put people first, not person first, but the plural. How do you find something that works for people in an organization? And so that's really what we're all about in everything that we do. And the Leadership Academy, it's just a way for people to come and access that easily, whatever, whenever they want.
Got it. You know, so there's a couple comments you made that I thought it was fascinating, the language that you used. So, you know, one of them that I thought was interesting is you mentioned, you know, people, not person first. So walk me through, you know, why you kind of made sure you called that out a little bit. I guess I want to dive into that a little bit.
Well, it is a misunderstanding. So for any company, and there are quite a few anymore, any company that says people first is one of their values, this is a stumbling point. And so I like to make the distinction. Someone in an organization gets to a place where they don't feel like their needs are being considered. And maybe they're quick to say, hey, you're not putting me first. You're not putting people first. Well, there's a difference. Sometimes we can't put a single individual first if it takes away from what we're trying to do for people more broadly, employees, customers, whoever it might be. So looking bigger picture and helping people to see that bigger picture perspective is part of the deliberate choice about the plural people.
Absolutely. It reminds me, and I'm sure many HR professionals listening to this are know exactly what I'm talking about. It's the conversation that you have with the individual about a process that's a challenge for them. And it would be really easy if you just changed one thing. But you have to have the broader context of what that does for the person in front of them and the person behind them, right? It's like,
absolutely.
Well, yeah, this would make your life easier, but it would make everybody else's life harder. So like, you know, let's come up with an alternative solution here. Mm-hmm. The other thing I wanted to talk about, which is really one of the items that I was really excited to dig into today, was you used the word potential. And, you know, it, depending on your school of thought, you know, that word can be a little bit, you know, inflammatory and, you know, like, because we associate that word with how we have thought about our talent systems, you know, and a lot of times we've labeled people with the label of levels of potential, right? So high potential, low potential, mid potential. And what I'm really getting at is the ever loved and utilized 9-box talent review model, which before we hit record, we were talking about a little bit, like that's the school that I was brought up in. You know, I also started in a Fortune 500 company, and they had all the systems, all the structures. And one of those structures was the 9-box. So, so I'm going to pause there because, you have a fresh approach to the 9-box. So I'd like to understand maybe, first of all, what prompted you to come up with a different approach, to the 9-box? And then if you'll humor me and give me a little bit of insight into your fresh approach.
Absolutely. So the 9-box talent review approach that so many HR professionals likely use and are familiar with. It was developed first by McKinsey. It was developed for GE, and that was in 1970. So what is that, 53 years ago? You know, just, it's ancient. And that's maybe the first clue that there's something that isn't up to date. So when I was a director with a Fortune 500 company, I participated in the standard talent review process across the organization. And my input, along with just 6 other people in our ivory tower corporate office, right? The 6 of us, we determined how senior executives in 31 markets were paid, how they were promoted, how they were perceived and everything that they did. And those impressions that we offered, they had the power to override facts and figures. And the impact of our mostly unfounded opinions lasted far longer than whatever formed our impressions in the first place. So my initial experiences with it were that, you know, maybe something here isn't quite legit. Maybe there's too much subjectivity in this process. And you nailed it when you said that it's about potential, because those are the two dimensions. Performance, okay, that's easier to make it objective. But potential, how dare you think that you can assess my potential? I don't even know my own potential. And you know, in this day and age in the workplace, we have all these extra difficulties, all these challenges. We're short-staffed, we're burned out, we're constrained by trying to figure out, are we remote today or not? All the challenges that we have, and they influence me. They influence what I can do. They influence what I demonstrate. Plus, I might be a little disengaged and holding back, not applying my full discretionary effort. What you're doing as an employer has a bearing on how I show up. And then you're using that against me to assess my potential. It makes no sense in my opinion. So that's my beef with the model as it stands. It's the dimension called potential. Part 2 of your question was, so Deb, what do you think we should do differently? And I think it's just as easy as let's replace that dimension, that arbitrary, subjective, insulting dimension. Let's not tap or cap people by something that's subjective. But instead, if we take a look at the dimension of performance, keep it as it is, that's what people do, right? What people do, how much of it they do. But let's make the other dimension how they go about doing it. And let's try to make that every bit as objective as those performance indicators. The way you do that is you define how we do things here. Use your values. What do your values look like in action? Set professional standards, but codify them with examples of behavior. This is what it looks like when somebody's excelling. This is what it looks like when somebody's average. This is what it looks like when they're not meeting those standards. And if we can get to now the two dimensions are what you do and how you do it, and it's all behavioral and it's all objective, keep it as a 9 box, but take that subjective potential piece out. And by the way, you'll also be taking out a whole lot of unconscious bias and other challenges that you're facing if you're trying to look at people through a subjective lens. So win-win, and you won't have people anymore that you're labeling, high po, low po. Most people are really just po-po, right? Once they find out about it, they're feeling passed over and pissed off. So let's just stop.
Po-po, passed over, pissed off. I like that. So I think, I've had a couple light bulb moments as you were talking about that. I think the first one, I tend to agree is potential is so subjective, right? And in fact, if anybody's familiar with Steve Brown, that was he was on our show a couple of years ago, and that was one of his big pieces, is like, kill that word, right? Like you don't know what somebody's potential really is. Like you said, sometimes you don't even know what your potential is. And oh, by the way, sometimes your potential ebbs and flows depending upon the day that you're having, the week that you're having, the year that you're having. It's just an unfair measurement. And what I've seen, I've been in the room just like you were in the room, Deb, back when you were an HR director. I've been in the room and I've had to be the person sitting there thinking about these hypos and going, are these hypos actually really hypos, or are they just similar to the people that think they're hypos, right? The whole ever loved halo effect, or is this person friends with this person outside of work and they like this person and they get along, or they share interests, or they like the same sports teams, for God's sakes. There's all these different reasons that somebody could be high potential. And many of them are fallacies.
They're unconscious biases. You're talking about familiarity bias, affinity bias, talking about proximity bias, right? All of those. And then how about conformity bias? It's easy to pass through. Well, they've been hypo the last 2 years. Let's just keep them there.
Yeah. They haven't delivered a project in 2 years, but they've been hypo for the last 2 years. So, we might as well, we don't want to make them mad. So we'll just leave them on the list.
Yeah.
And I think the other thing too, and I say this with all, all honesty, like as an extrovert, like it helps me, just because I'm like the loudest one in the room a lot of times. Right. And so a lot of times you're also passing over people that actually have an extreme amount of potential to do wonderful things, but they're just not like noisy enough, right? Or they're not noticed as much as people who are. And a lot of times I think that we can put people and categorize people unfairly to the point that then they either A, quit, or they're just underutilized in your organization. So
I agree. Style over substance. We can deceive ourselves if we are looking for something superficial.
Yeah. That's my own bias. Like, I know that about I'm just noisy, right? So, which is why I have a podcast. I mean, let's be honest, right? So, trying to fit into my category here. So I think that potential one, I think that's a really important call out. I guess one question that I have that I'm curious to get your perspective on is, one of the challenges with disrupting and being a rebel and driving an innovation is you're fighting against the current. And because this has been around since 1970, GE did it, and everybody assumes, well, if GE did it, then it must be right. Let's not look at GE's current stock price, but that be that as it may. And But what you'll find so often is if you want to make a change to that type of model, you are fighting against the current. And typically that current is somebody sitting in like an executive level chair that was raised with that school of thought or has always used this tool and doesn't necessarily see a need to change it. So Deb, what advice or guidance would you give us as we sit here in these seats and we're all probably shaking our heads and agreeing with what you and I are talking about? But then what do we do? How do we overcome this natural kind of inertia with a tool like the Nine Box?
You know, I have two responses. The first is, let's get their attention. Let's get their attention because here during the Great Resignation, employee engagement matters more than ever. And if you want to retain people, you have to be careful about what you do. So we know through research that employees don't really like the nine box model. If they know about it, they have some suspicion around it. And if you've got stack ranking like GE did, if you could only put 20% of your people in the top boxes, that means you're providing less. You're thinking less of and you're providing less to 80% of your workforce. Less opportunity, less esteem, less support, less ennoblement, you name it. So can you really, this is the question I'd be posing to people who want to keep the nine box, can you really afford to disenfranchise 80% of your employees? Wouldn't it make more sense to create more development opportunities, more support, more ways to create a sense of belonging and a belief in the organization, an organization that believes in every employee? So that's my first thought is let's leverage employee engagement and what we know about that. And then I'd offer the caution. If you are using the nine box model and you're using it in a way that sets those thresholds at like 20% and 80%, I would caution you because there has been litigation about stack ranking systems. There's a tongue twister.
We were all following you. It's all good.
Yeah. So stack ranking systems, they're subjective. They're arbitrary. They allow for discrimination. I'm not making that up. It's been found to be true in courts of law. And that's why Ford and Microsoft and Accenture and, you know, lots of other companies, they've all dumped ranking systems. Maybe it's time for other companies to do that too.
Yeah, if all else fails, if there's lawsuit risk, right, that can usually get an executive's attention, right? You know, usually you don't want to start there necessarily, but you know, coming from somebody who worked at an organization that was a plaintiff in one of those lawsuits, or a defendant in one of the lawsuits, rather, change now before you're in that situation. But you know, I think it's a really important topic to think about because and so often in our world of human resources, it's easier to just take the tool that's already there. Okay. But I'll share a story that a personal story. When I was in an organization, we did nine box and I'm the guy doing the nine box. And then of course there's a nine box about me and anybody, you know, and so it's like this big system that we would utilize. And at one point, I went into my leader's office, and at that time I was planning to get married. I was getting ready to start a family. I wanted to put down roots in the town that I was living in, and you know, I just enjoyed living there. And so I went in and I told them, it was my HR leader. I said, I don't want to be relocatable for the next few years. I want to put down roots. We want to start a family, and then once we've done that, then you know, we can have that dialogue. And he looked me dead in the eye and he goes, okay, but you won't be high potential anymore.
Oh,
and I'm like, wait a minute. Okay. You tell me that one of our values is integrity and I'm coming to you in advance, trying to have integrity in our relationship as, you know, employer, employee. And you're telling me by doing that now I'm kicked off the list. And, you know, and at that point I'm like, okay, whatever. But to your point, what happened next over the next year is the treatment that I got from my employer after that change in status was terrible. Right. Terrible employee experience. You know, I lost all my training opportunities, didn't get to like, you know, go, you know, do the things that were kind of enjoyable. I was kind of, you know, I was pulled off of certain like project teams that were enriching and valuable and taught me so much in my role. And you know, and I had a conversation at one point with one of my, one of the other leaders in the organization. And he said, listen, when you said you couldn't relocate, you basically shot your head off with a shotgun in this organization. You might as well just go find another job. So I'm like, well,
you can't get a bottle.
So I went and found another job, right? I mean, but that's a real life story. And you know, it's one of those things that as an HR professional, I'm like, okay, this is effed up. I'm not going to do this in my organization. I don't want this to happen to anybody else. Right. And I think if anybody else has had that sort of situation, or anybody's had that happen to an employee within the organization, it's on us as leaders of organizations to not let that kind of thing happen. So I'll get off my soapbox, but that's a true story.
I'm going to give your former employer a little bit of credit, and then I'm going to take it away. But the credit they get is that they had objective criteria. So like it or not, you know, that's a crummy criteria, but they had an objective criterion.
Fair.
Unfortunately, right, they weren't transparent about it. If you're going to have those, let everybody know about it ahead of time. Here's what we expect for the people that we're going to invest development dollars into. Put it out for mass consumption if you're going to do that.
Right, right. Yeah. Yeah, so, you know, I mean, it all worked out fine in the end. You know, my career is intact. But, you know, certainly that organization, you know, had an opportunity for improvement. So, you know, to this day, you know, there's skepticism from my standpoint as far as how the 9-box should be leveraged and utilized. The other thing I want to talk about a little bit, so, and I think this is really where I think a lot of the light bulbs for me went off when you were talking about it, is the changing of potential to something that's objective. And, you know, so you had mentioned, you know, how somebody goes about doing the work that they do. And I think, you know, to me, then I immediately went to like a kind of a competency framework or a model of, you know, like really defining behaviors. Am I on the right track there? You know, how should we think about the how? Because that could also be subjective potentially.
Well, I do think behaviors are a great, great way to keep it more objective. And being able to define the behaviors, not just this is what we expect, but here's what it looks like underperformance. Here's what it looks like top level performance. Really give that range to people, paint a very, very clear picture. And this includes your organizational values. Translate them into the actions or the behaviors that you believe are appropriate demonstrations of those values. Because something like integrity, I mean, sure, we all have a working knowledge of what that word means, but I don't know how to activate that so that it's seen by you and appreciated by you. Let's just take the mystery away.
I think that's a really powerful concept. And I think I've seen that done well, and I've seen it done really poorly. Right. So I guess I'm curious what for the organizations that are going to use this type of model, and they're going to start to measure, you know, maybe let's just say high, medium, low behaviors, you know, what are some ways that an organization can do this in a way that is really truly objective and understood by the broader organization, so that there's not some of that kind of that mystery around it?
Well, it takes a little time to set up, like most systems do, that if you're going to do it well. And part of that setup is that you communicate it very, very transparently. You know, I recommend that you create a little framework. If these are the behaviors, the competencies, the values of how you do the work, spell them out for me. Give me a document. Have a mini training session or communication session with me. Have me sign off on it that I understood it. And then give me coaching and feedback and regular inputs about how I am or am not living up to that. And I think it's like anything, right? People will rise to your expectations if you're clear about those expectations. When you don't have the transparency, you have an inherent unfairness. Why are you holding me to a standard that I don't even know about? I want to meet and exceed your standards, but I can't if they're shrouded in some kind of mystery. So let's just put it all out there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. You know, I think, you know, you use this, I think this is a perfect kind of example, you know, the example of integrity, right? You know, we all think we know what that means, but when you really look at how you define that, people interpret that completely differently, right? And high integrity behaviors in someone's mind may be very different than high integrity behaviors in somebody else's mind. And so if you don't have a common, you know, almost like a vocabulary, a dictionary behind it, then you're going to struggle. And so is that something, do you help with that type of, like that type of framework at People First Productivity Solutions then, I'm assuming?
Absolutely. Yeah. And the consulting we do with HR organizations or smaller organizations that may just have one or no HR folks, we help. We build the expectations, we build the performance expectations, as well as the just sort of the standards of how we operate around here. We do competencies and job descriptions, but ultimately we get to this place where there's something cohesive. It's competencies and behaviors that wraps around the people systems so that everybody has simplicity and a high degree of understanding around it.
I want to pause there for a minute because I think that's a really critical way to think about it. And that's that you use the word wrap around, right? Like that this is a part of the entire system. So walk me through what that looks like. You know, so you've gone in and you've kind of, you know, we've been talking about the nine box, but you and I both know it's much larger than that. The nine box is really just a tool, and there's a system underlying that tool. So when you say like a wraparound system, what does that mean to you? How do you think about that in the context of the overall kind of the HR talent system and structures?
Well, I'm biased toward competencies. So you as a podcaster, Kyle, what are the competencies needed to really excel in creating a podcast and in delivering that podcast and marketing that podcast? You know, let me find those, let's call it 10 competencies that really, really don't describe Kyle, but they describe the perfect ideal candidate for the job that you happen to be doing right now. Now I'm going to use that to hire and source candidates. Who are the people who are the closest match to my pre-established, very well-defined competencies? And when I do hire somebody who was a close match, what did they have some opportunities for development in? Let me just start there. Day one is their onboarding. I know what those opportunities are for them to develop, and I'm going to set my expectations for growth. The job description includes the competencies. The onboarding has mention of them, the regular check-ins and stay interviews and performance appraisals that we do, the KPIs, they all reflect the growth in competencies and the ways that you're acquiring and building them. Well, now talent review time comes along, nine box model, it's the same thing. We're not springing something new into the mix. The behaviors are similar. When we look to promote somebody internally, we look at the next job level. The next job level is a different set of competencies, perhaps, or you want to move somewhere diagonally, crosswise, cross-functionally in the organization. You've always got something that you can go to and see how close a match are you? What would you need to do to develop? Because competencies give you that awesome foundation.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know, I think it's a really important thing from my standpoint, at least to the seat that I sit in now, is that whenever you're using a tool such as Ninebox, competencies, you know, or something as simple as a performance evaluation or an interview guide, that it all connects, right? That it's not like the flavor of the month, like this is what HR says we need to do this month or that month, like. It should all come down to kind of the foundational systems that matter, and you know, I tend to be a little bit biased towards competencies as well. That's kind of the school of thought that I was, you know, kind of spent a lot of time in. But the reality is, I've seen it work when you actually define what somebody should be doing, and then you define how they should be doing it, and you do that in an objective way. Now you've put in like the guardrails for somebody's success or failure at their job, and it just makes everything easier. You know, that's, it's It's really, you know, really all it is we're just trying, we're a little bit lazy. We just want to make our jobs a little bit easier, right? So let's all be a little lazy and make our lives easier.
Absolutely. And protect ourselves from accusations of favoritism or not giving somebody a fair shot. This is the system.
Yes, absolutely. And you know, I think, you know, the other thing I always say is like, listen, it's not about not getting sued, right? Or like, you know, it's not about compliance. It's not necessarily, that's not what it's about. But it is about making that sure that you have a system that doesn't put you at risk for those things, right? So it's like, if you do it right, if you focus on people first, you won't have to worry about that stuff, right? If people feel like they were treated fairly and they were treated fairly and you had objective, you know, criteria, A, they're going to perform more effectively. And if they don't perform effectively and it goes south, they're not going to sue you. And if they do, you're going to have objective criteria why, you know, like all, it all works together in the system. So for anybody out there that's like, that's thinking about their system or thinking about their structure or thinking, oh yeah, our 9-box process, we need to change it. Well, I think before you jump in and start just throwing tools at it, make sure you've got that underlying foundation, you know, in place first. So
I agree. And you know what? Before anybody ever ends up in a courtroom, they're in the boardroom, the Zoom room, the break room. And in all those places, you want to be sure that they're highly engaged and that they're feeling good about the work that they're doing. And so when I talk about unfairness or favoritism, it's about like the immediate impact.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. My head's in the lawsuit clouds most of the time.
Of course.
So yeah, it's the, wonderful conversation. We could probably keep going. Like we could go through all of these, I could probably just go through the list of all the old like McKinsey/GE tools that we used to, you know,
used.
We could go through all of them. We could start like just like X in and O, and we could whiteboard this whole thing over the next 9 hours, but we don't have 9 hours. So we'll do that next time. We'll just do like, we'll just go full like 9-hour podcast, bring popcorn. It'll be a good time. But for the purposes of our time today and with respect of your time, I'm going to shift gears. We're going to go to the Rebel HR flash round. Are you ready?
Okay.
All right. Perfect. Question number one, where does HR need to rebel?
I think it's still where we are right here. It's people practices. People want to feel ennobled. They want a sense of belonging. They want to know that the company cares about their well-being. And by necessity, HR sometimes focuses on compliance and doesn't look at individuals. And we need to strike that balance. We need to rebel a little more towards the side of let's make sure people are understanding that we actually do care about them. We need them. We want them to feel a sense of satisfaction in the work they do.
Love that. Question number two, who should we be listening to?
I think I'll have to go ahead and say this podcast. You've got some pretty good guests talking about a lot of very interesting things and in a professional way. But mainly, really, the answer is our employees. Let's listen to the front lines. Let's not just let it all filter up through a supervisor or manager. Get out there in the trenches. Talk to people.
Absolutely. Yeah, we can't do our jobs just sitting in an office. You know, I appreciate the podcast call out, but you can't just sit in an office, listen to a podcast and have all the great ideas. You've got to go listen to your organization, listen to your employees, listen to your, what I call your internal customer group, right? So go out and listen. All right. Last question. How can our listeners connect with you and learn more?
And I hope they will. So go to the Leadership Academy and find some free classes that you like. PeopleFirstPotential.com. All three words are spelled out, PeopleFirstPotential.com. Or you can email me or connect with me on LinkedIn. I always love hearing from folks. I'm Deb Calvert, and my email address is deb.calvert@peoplefirstps.com, the PS standing for Productivity Solutions.
Absolutely. And we will have all that information in the show notes. So open up your podcast player. You can click right in. There's a bunch of wonderful tools out there. Just really appreciate you putting all that out in the world, Deb. And thank you for spending some time and sharing your expertise with us today.
Well, Kyle, really my pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you. All right. That does it for the Rebel HR podcast. Big thank you to our guests. Follow us on Facebook at Rebel HR Podcast, Twitter at Rebel HR Guy, or see our website at rebelhumanresources.com. The views and opinions expressed by Rebel HR Podcast are those of the authors and do not necessarily reflect the official policy or position of any of the organizations that we represent. No animals were harmed during the filming of this podcast.
Baby.